I think you're right. I mean, so you get me thinking of a couple of things. One, which is, you know, all the stuff that can't fully be colonized and that sort of lays just beyond the reach of imperial powers that then gets taken up as a site and source of resistance. And that's not to fetishize the sort of revolutionary potential of colonized people in colonized spaces, but rather to acknowledge the fact that they continue to persist despite being devastated economically, geologically, so on and so forth, attests to the fact that there is something actually uncolonizable. I've been particularly interested in the way that that ends up getting presented through what we think of as, or what, through a particular kind of language of kinship. So kinship to other colonized peoples, kinship to the land as well. And I've gotten there by thinking through a series of thinkers who are sort of my political North Star, from, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois to Walter Rodney and Vijay Prashad, who I know you had on not that long ago. But there's a way in which the trope of family, right, that we identify as kin, becomes a way of resisting another kind of sort of social construction that would have, that actually literally thrived off of the destruction and dissolution of families, that being empire. And so I've been thinking lately about how particular family lines, like those that then get streets named after them, make their fortune and gain, consolidate their wealth precisely by destroying the families of darker peoples, you know. And it's this to then turn around and for darker people to hail one another as family is to sort of show a kind of an indomitable spirit and a kind of solidarity that I think is really, it's crucial. I think it's crucial to resisting the sort of ongoing lived legacies of colonialism and imperialism from the 19th century and before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And it's the economic power is what they bequeath to each other, right? And like economic and military and kind of geopolitical power, that's what they inherited. And that's the important thing. So like the street names and the names of the institutions and the names on the buildings and stuff, that's all whatever. That's gravy, right? That's just spiking the football historically, right? Like the real power, though, is in continuing a class of people, continuing and the continuance, a continuation of a class of people who can parasitically continue to parasitically suck off of and exist off of the resources and the labor and the earth of neo-colonized people, right? Because we know that, like, for all of our talk of like post-coloniality, right, like we know that, like, there's, like, you know, that for a lot of people on the planet, if not most, like the phrase like post-colonialism, have they left, you know, is a very real meaningful sort of like indictment of like our understanding of these eras, right? Is that, oh, because the formal British European empires that we knew and kind of set our clocks to in terms of periodization and the sort of scopes of history and, you know, just like the institutional things that, oh, I'm a scholar of the French Empire, I'm a scholar of the Europe, you know, like, because those gave way or those, you know, ended or whatever you want to say, like, supposedly, then that forced us to kind of like put into this mode of like post-coloniality, right? Like post, and to like put aside the meaning of that phrase altogether, who cares? Like that thing's been beaten to death. But it's also like in that kind of erasure, though, at least, and this is kind of what we talked about last time, very unproductively. This is attempt number two at an interview. But like that kind of leftover is that kind of frothy leftover of like these centuries of empire, cultural leftover, that is. That becomes the substance of so much, like a disproportionate amount of academic work because of part of the nature of academic work, but also for other material relation like reasons too. Like academic work is like, it needs people who wrote letters, people who build archives, people who like recorded themselves in their daily lives, people who textualized themselves, people who are lucky enough to have done that and also not have their text burnt by ensuing occupiers. Like, you know, like that's also important too, right? So like, of course, the shape of historical inquiry and scholastic inquiry in our Anglophone world naturally took the form of like, okay, these are the people who had documents left over and these aren't. Let's study the ones on the left, because that's much easier, like, because that makes sense to us.
I mean, that's exactly it. And you know, I think the issue is then, what does it mean to do recovery work and to sort of excavate the stories that and lives that, you know, that were destroyed. And it's hard. And there's a lot of, you know, smart people who've theorized it in ways that are much more complex than I'm able to. But for me, it just presents itself as a qualitative and unqualified good. You know, that what we do as scholars be guided by a principle whereby we acknowledge and try and pay tribute to these lives that were destroyed. These lives, and again, I mean, to return to something I said before, families, you know, so I think like there's this ongoing thing that I haven't been able to get out of my head. I don't know if you probably saw it. It's sort of a joke too. When I was on Twitter, like I remember, you know, seeing various iterations of it, but then I saw an article on it at some point where someone's called "Do White People Have Cousins?" Do you remember that? Have you ever
yeah,
seen that?
I remember. I've thought this too a lot too.
So that's something, right? So these I'm trying to sort of think through what you're saying in line with that and think about all those letters that get written, you know, and that then get read 100, 200, 300 years later by scholars from one European, you know, celebrity to another European celebrity, or people who became celebrities precisely because their letters lasted. But the solidification of a kin network through the sort of written letter that sort of attests to the fact that they were bonded together, but that sort of can never be divorced of the fact that their entire existence is propped up by the theft of land and resources from the darker world. Yeah. You know, so you have all of that going on, again, like coextensive with and reliant upon the destruction of other families, right? The destruction of nuclear families and non-nuclear families and ways of understanding kinship that sort of extend through the idea of the cousin. And I mean, this is actually where I wanted to start this conversation, was to by asking you about, you know, you when you reach out to me, you call me Habibi. What does that mean to you?
I mean that's its own cultural appropriation, I must say. Yeah. because it's like you know, at some point in my life I adopted Arabic and specifically like the question of Palestine, although it later got extended to kind of West Asia. It sort of totally is kind of like my, you know, for lack of a better word, kind of obsession. And mm-hmm. at a certain point, like, that involved learning Arabic and or sort of embrace sort of, you know, immersing myself into Arabic and the mm-hmm. study of Arabic. And I eventually dropped it off and switched to German, which is talk about quite the change. But I mean, that's its own episode. But like that what stayed with me though is like the affectionate nature of daily speech of like, you know, and you know, what I later understood, I thought I was like, oh, it's an Arab thing. But of course, as an Iranian, you know, like I knew growing up, like we have this thing, you know, we call people John, or, you know, like mm-hmm. this kind of, you know, it is a, there are these romantic, not romantic, they're like, mm-hmm. What is the actual linguistic term? I guess they're, I don't know, I should have looked it up. But like these kind of articulations of non-romantic love, right? Mm-hmm. Which are, or like they're neutral. I mean, I guess And literally, I mean, Habibi is my love, and it is invoked in a lot of, it's the male, it's like the male, it's like the gender, you know, but I don't think Habib, I used to think Habibti was used. And I guess some people do use it colloquially, but like, apparently in poetry and stuff, it's not gendered. Like, it's just Habibi, but someone else can correct me better. But like, I basically, that's like a mark of warm friendship and like non-romantic love. Yeah, like it is a useful way of kind of like signaling to people that like, oh, you're like someone I consider like a warm friend, and it means a lot to me that like I'm talking to.
So that's what I mean. This is sort of a long way around back to where we started, but that's what I was trying to express about the ties that are, they're beyond affective, really. They're bound up with too many sort of feelings and relationships to sort of reduce them to merely affective. But there's certain ties that cannot be colonized, or that in the, when we're faced with the displacement of peoples, we reforge those kinship networks through these terms, right? And they're linguistic, but they're not merely linguistic. It's about the way we forge communities among people who we assume get it. I mean, that's really, that's where I was thinking about, you know, when we were talking about recording this, about the fact that our kinship, yours and mine, sort of emerges out of your calling me Habibi, right? And that is a way that of moving beyond the fact that we have, you know, totally different geopolitical autobiographies, you know, which is to say West Asia is not South Asia, right? We have different sort of ancestry patterns, different language, right?
Like, and different experiences of colonization, right? Like it's totally completely different. The experience, the South Asian experience is really unique in the world, I think. Like there's nothing, because other countries have been colonized as long as South Asia, all parts of South Asia. However, I don't know how true that is, because the streak that the British had in South Asia is quite something in history, and the scale, it was pretty and impressive. The depth.
No, yeah, no. I mean, that's it. So, what, I mean, you raise another issue too, which has to do with this idea of kinship, which is, it's not, I think, when done right, a matter of eliding those differences, right, and saying like, okay, we're identical. It is about the acknowledgement that there are different sort of forms of colonization, different forms of displacement, of exploitation. Despite all those differences, they become the sort of source for finding connections with other people in the world. And again, through the terms, through Habibi, right? Through Yar, through John, right? These ways of signaling kinship that aren't meant to erase difference. Right. They're meant to work through difference.
I mean, what's funny too is that the way that like the word dear became so normalized and professionalized, like dear, that, but like dear is supposed to be, it has that dual role. God, look at me, I'm a Derridian here. But like dear has like dear reader, dear listener, but also like the dear as like a, what's the phrase? It's not an inter something. What's a, the, a greeting, inter, I don't remember, like a greeting, what's the word I'm looking for?
The performative or illocutionary and that stuff?
Yes, like that, it's played that role, and it's, and you do that with people you don't know, right? In the form of like, dear professor so-and-so, like you're not dear to me at all. But like, like that is a lie. I don't even know who you are. You're a property manager. Like you're not dear at all. But like that is, it's a funny place that's where dear ended up. And it's only that, and most of the time dear, when people say it in English, it's done, I would say, I mean, I guess you can't, how do you know, Mara? I would say the majority of the time, predominant majority of the time, it's in the context of like a romantic life partner, right? That it's like, oh, my dear, like come here, like, yes, dear, you know, and that's like the only person who gets it. Whereas, you know, like Habibi, John, Aziz, like these things are pretty, I'm trying to think of like, what else do we have in English that like comes even close? But we were supposed to be talking about Lord Elgin. Now we're off track once again.
We're not. The first thing I want to say is you reminded me of And if your listeners don't know it, this Kara Walker piece called "Dear You Fucking Hypocritical Twerp," I'm gonna leave it there. But no, we're not actually. So my thinking about the various Lord Elgins or Lords Elgin has had to do with precisely the fact that they're this family in British history. I mean, most famously known for the theft of the Parthenon marbles, but a family that whose imperially gained fortunes were passed down from one to the next. I mean, and they were all named like Charles and Thomas and William. I mean, the names repeat themselves in this sort of common but also sort of weirdly telling pattern of repetition whereby the sons of the fathers continue to sort of commit the kind of colonial sins of their predecessors. So you have, Thomas Bruce, who was the Lord Elgin who stole the Parthenon marbles, which, you know, I was got interested in because I'm a romanticist by training, and Keats adored the marbles, and Lord Byron hated Elgin. So the Elgin family becomes bound up in this series of controversies circulating among precisely that sort of frothy leftover of cultural figures that you were talking about before, the people that end up getting the most attention. But so I was interested in how the Elgins played out, and learned something that, I don't know, maybe your listeners already know this, that so Elgin's son was James Bruce, the eighth Lord Elgin, who burned down the summer palace at Beijing in retaliation for the Chinese capture of British hostages. And before that, he had worked to stifle voting rights in Jamaica when he was governor there. So it's this way that the family name Elgin and the family wealth passes on, and they're still going. I don't know what they're on, like the 12th or 13th Lord Elgin now. And it happens through the destruction of cultures and lives of people across the colonized world. So it's fascinating to me the way that their family line, and again, it's not unique in the history of European nobility. I mean, also, you know, Fanon said, in Europe, the family is the miniature of the nation. So there's this way in which, you know, Europe more broadly, I think, is indicted in this collapsing of the family line into the expansion of the nation, right? Where all the babies, you know, the white babies that are born are going to go on to become future colonizers and so on and so forth. The way that proceeds precisely by the disruption and destruction of the darker world, right? And so that became really fascinating to me. And then I started to think about, okay, what are the ways in which, as family lines are consolidated in Europe through the destruction of family lines among the enslaved and indentured, what are the ways by which those colonized, displaced, enslaved peoples reconstitute the family? And I'm particularly interested in the way that happens across what we think of as racial lines. So what does solidarity among Afro-Guyanese and Indo-Guyanese people look like? And that's something that I got interested in particularly because I do other work on Guyana. You know, one of my sort of heroes, I think I mentioned earlier, Walter Rodney, was assassinated precisely because he was forging a sort of coalition of workers that didn't sit well with the Burnham government, which was not surprisingly backed by the West as a means of quelling the spread of leftist politics. So all of this, you know, I don't think the Lords Elgin take us away from the questions we've started to raise here about kinship, about solidarities, about colonization and resistance. In fact, I think when we've talked before, we've talked about all the bullshit that academia is and involves, but I think one of the upsides of it for me has been that it's been a space where I can sort of start to make these connections and sort of see, you know, see the way these political possibilities imagined by folks like Rodney, folks like Du Bois, you know, start to operate, and how kinship sort of matters to that. And also, it gets me thinking about like the sort of local, right? So there's beyond like the sort of political movements founded on solidarities among darker peoples, then again, there's these smaller solidarities that emerge when, you know, when you call me Habibi, you know, when we reach out to one another and sort of identify, you know, again, a non-identical but shared history of what Du Bois called common disaster.
Yeah, well, it's also like it's a class thing too, in a sense. There is a, not to be a vulgar Marxist, but like you and I shared a similar training and a similar institutional, we had a lot of overlap institutionally speaking, and it's a relationship that only later, years later, after I'd spent some time like away from academia, really in reality, and it's just, and it's more of a, it's more of my own failure. I don't blame this on anybody else. It's my own, my own sort of like inability to just see what's right in front of me, which was like me, an Iranian born, you know, like refugee of a dirty regime change war. Like my political subjectivity is not like the intended user of these institutions. It's like, it's not like, it's not what these institutions were built for, right? Like, and sure, like people end up in places that weren't intentional, that weren't, you know, in, you know, originally intended for them. That's happened. That's the nature of institutions, that they introduce new kinds of people to other new kinds of people, right? Like that's their whole point. And institutions actually play the role that village politics and town politics and local politics used to play in our lives, at least in a sense of like connecting us to people who will play a life, play a long time in our lives. But because of like the hyper individuated nature of like capitalism and like the growth of urban life as this hyper individualized per subject who's connected to, you know, maybe connected to their immediate family, but like that sort of cousin, the meaning of cousinhood, which is to say a sort of wider family, is you know, is you know, telephonic at best, right? That it's not based in a community. And this is something that I remember somebody that I was on an episode of the Red Power Hour with on the Red Nation podcast, and I remember Melanie saying this to me, the host. You know, when I was talking about one of these people who died during the whatever January 6th thing at the Capitol building in the U.S., like she's like this young woman or whatever my age, like she was like a pool cleaner or something, like she flew from Southern California, and like, you know, there were these kind of people who were like laughing about it and like whatever, there's like a human being died, fine, but like lots of human beings die and lots of people don't give a flying fuck, so like there is that. I'm not sort of being like whatever, but it's more the fact that like I was more like, you know, this is like a tragedy. This woman died for nothing. Like she gave her life for nothing to like be part of a stupid social media stunt. She could have like been at home. She could have like spent that time connecting with like her family or her people or her community. And Melanie said to me, it's like, Sina, these are settlers. They have no communities to speak of, and their histories and their historical connections to the land itself is very flimsy. So of course they'll hop on a plane and go halfway across the whatever, because you know their politics don't extend beyond the stupid cultural war that takes place on our Facebook page. Like that's it, that's all the roots of their politics are so shallow, whereby there are communities, say in South Asia, that sustain themselves through 3 centuries of genocidal imperial violence, that stayed alive, that reproduced, that survived, that rebuilt after countless, what, I mean, just after the first Indian uprising alone, 47, I was 57. Like just after that 50, they killed 10 million people. Like 10 million people. That's memory hold, and those people aren't deemed mournable, which is kind of the problem, I would say, of like, you know, this is the structural problem that you and I face, like in our shared, like in the sort of place of the academy, which is like the human dimensions of like the British experience have been 99% focused on the frilly fucking collars and the square dancing and the fucking long ass sentences of the 18th and 19th century, right? Like, or whatever, poetry, whatever, fine.
No, you're right, yeah.
For all you freaks out there who don't live their lives by novels like the rest of us normal people. But like, that's 99% of that world comes to us from these nice, shiny, you know, like Elgin marble, whatever, right? Like that's,
yeah.
Like, whereas like the rape and pillaging and the wholesale like erasure of, like, actually speaking, billions of people, like, yeah, it's just like, oh, like that's just for the freaks, that's just for like the, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm not saying people in our wing of the humanities don't talk about this stuff, but we certainly don't talk about it enough, and we certainly don't like institutionalize that learning, because if they did, and it's not a moral thing, it's not like an ethical, I mean, maybe it is, whatever, but like, it's also like a very rational thing to not be like, Here is the genocides that they did.
Right.
Like that wouldn't be good for the institution of the humanities. It would push a lot of people away, because we're also not a society like that likes to confront that stuff, that likes, that like appreciates that. I mean, I guess it's not about liking or anything, but like that is something that people in education is seen as this beautiful, aesthetically constructive thing, whereby knowledge fills this person with goodness, and that sweet, like soft serve ice cream. But like, people don't want to know about like the corpses and the bodies, or if they do, it's very exceptional circumstances, when it's certain kinds of people dying, when it's like a certain mournability.
No, I think you're right. I mean, the other time I think that it becomes palatable is when, to sort of come back to a term you just introduced, is when it's aestheticized, right? So when you can make a Hollywood picture about it, and when the narrative can be sort of reinserted into a sort of broader scheme of, you know, cultural production that centers a particular American viewpoint, then it becomes palatable, right? So no, I mean, you're right. It's why, and in terms of the square dances and the long sentences, you know, my dear friend and collaborator and comrade Tricia Matthew, you know, who works on the Regency on early 19th century England, has this phrase that just sticks with me all the time. You know, if you're going to imagine the drawing room and you're going to imagine, you know, them pouring the cup of tea, and you want to relive that fantasy of, you know, 18th and 19th century sort of glamour, don't forget that the hand that poured the tea is also the hand that cracked the whip.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I did a lot of other fucking worse things than that. That to me is, yeah, that's the hardest thing to think. Like, it's also like deeply unpleasant thing to do to yourself every day of your life when thinking like, just, but then like, I can't help but like boil in rage when I see like this obvious kind of like aestheticizing of like the crown and like Bridgerton and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And like, even then, this development of like race blind casting and stuff is supposed to like paper over the reality that like human lives were like fed to these people, like literally and figuratively. Like, these people ate part of the planet, like their flesh, like if not literally, then figuratively. Mm-hmm. Like, the way, like, it's like, you know, George Washington, didn't he have like how many teeth pulled out of the mouths of Africa? Like, if that's not a metaphor for settler colonialism, I don't know what is. That like the mouth of liberal freedom and like legacy is actually like the bones of the like African slaves that were stolen and put to work building your dream for you, which you like sit and like drink your apple, you know, drink your whiskey and enjoy. And, you know, like, that to me is like, how do you, like, you know, that is the British story, right? Like, all those scenes of, like, all those, like, you know, all those scenes of slavery in the deep American South, that is the British Empire, even if it's in its American guise. But, like, you know, it's very convenient, the sort of silos, the sort of institutional silos that have been put in place over, like, the last 100 years, whereby the, you know, like, the regencies of like the who was king or like monarch at that era becomes like the kind of like it becomes kind of like the container that holds everything together. It's like, okay, here are some dates that hold everything together. It's arbitrary, sure, but that's what we have. But like, that's a way of like continuing the memory of these people and honoring them. And that's why, like, when people were like, you know, last summer, or I can't remember, was it 2 summers ago? It was 2 summers ago. Like, during the uprising, like, of course people tore down those statues. Of course people wanted to not see that stuff anymore.
Yeah.
People don't want to be subjected to, like, white supremacy's, like, you know, spiking of the football, like, centuries after the fact. I mean, like, that's the thing. And so I find it, you know, on the one hand, it's hard to do what you do, like, to sort of, like, dig in, like, to, like, do these archaeologies and, like, pursue these characters who, you know, in reality wouldn't have given much of our own humanity much of a thought, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
These people would have detested us if we had met them.
No,
I guess that's something I never thought about, that, like, if I had met Charles Dickens, he would have, like, spat in my face.
I literally have that line in my, a line about that in my first book, actually, where I say, you know, like, nah, you know, I love Byron Keats and Shelley, and they would not have loved me in return. Not even Byron, right? Because for Byron, I wouldn't have been Oriental enough.
Yeah.
You know, I would have been some, like, watered down version of, like, the kind of, like, spice that he was looking for. So you do it, you know, and again, I mean, and I've often thought, like, okay, well, you know, while we're tearing down monuments, I assume, like, the Norton Anthology of English Literature is one of the ones we're going to tear down, right? But it turns out we're not.
No.
We're in fact doubling down on new Norton editions, and, you know, but we'll add one or two, you know, black or brown writers or yellow writers, writers.
We'll let black
or
brown scholars edit those collections. That's even better.
I mean, there it
is.
You
like,
know?
That's the weird state we're in, where you have this increasing, like sort of capital D diversification of the facultariat.
And, yeah.
I mean, funny enough, it happened at the time when everything was ending, which is kind of funny.
Right.
They, like, saved us the last gasp.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's...
Here you go. Enjoy.
But that is like the colonial story, right? Like, we'll take all the resources and then leave the darker peoples the scraps that are left, right? Good luck. Here's your dry well. Enjoy it.
I hope you write a fest shrift about me one day. but it's like, you know, like, that it would be harder to burn down, and I'm not saying you should, I'm not calling for that, but, like, it would be harder, more like, it would be more of a detrimental blow to end the Norton edition than it would be to burn down, like, Yale or Princeton. Like, those things can be rebuilt. Like, they have lots of money. They're fine. They'll be fine. But, like, the institutions are the ones that live in our head, which is, like, the institution of English literature, of, like, Britishness, and how it goes hand in hand with a very deep and profound and, like, really never-ending, like, nostalgia for itself, and, like, a whitewashed nostalgia that aestheticizes everything. I mean, like, I never watched Bridgerton. I just remember how horny it was. Like, I knew that it was, like, very horny. And it's like the pornography is not just in the flesh, but it's in the transformation of this very violent time of human history into pure aesthetics of, like, human, like, craft, of, like, all the world's resources siphoned into the private homes of the 1% of the 1% of the 1% of this island off the coast of Europe. Like, that's the reality. Like, that's the thing. And so, like, for me, this is the tricky thing, is that, like, how do you go about understanding our modern world without understanding the British Empire, without reading their authors, right? Like, without getting to know how they divided the world up in their heads and, you know, on military maps and stuff. Like, how do you understand that world without doing that, without having to dedicate your life to its furtherance, right? Without having to, like, keep having to resell that package of the world. And that's something that, A, I never bothered to even try in my academic work. So I'm not even going to high road anyone on this. I was like, I didn't realize it. I didn't think that was the case. But in reality, I was like this fucking Europhile. I loved it, you know, but it was...
You know, and so like I'm not high-roading anyone on that, but like this is the structural reality I feel that we're stuck in, is that like, yes, you have to spend time with the British Empire. You have to learn what like Anglophone peoples did to the world and how they viewed the world. And you have to learn these things. You have to spend time with that. But yes, like you have to also set about somehow the destruction of these traditions and this way of speaking about the yeah. world and the centuries of Orientalism that it's bred into people that like, you know, can just be whipped up in a storm against any enemy.
I think, I mean, you're dead ass. I haven't seen Bridgerton either. I'm sort of embarrassed to admit, because I think I'm supposed to have watched it, given my area of research. But I think that the other thing that you're making me, sort of, you're putting me in mind of is that it's not an individual project. You know, you have one person studying, you know, the Lords Elgin, and there are many... you know, what Byron called senseless sons that were born to sort of destroy the world. You have another person studying the history of sort of revolution in post-colonial spaces or decolonized spaces. And, you know, neither one is sort of devoting their entire life to the study of what the other person does. But, you know, they come together to sort of to share knowledge and to figure shit out. I don't know. I mean, that might just be me trying to like soften the sort of like the blow, which is, you know, the blow being like, yeah, I'm part of the problem. I'm a US-based academic, man.
Bro, we're all part of the problem. That's it.
I mean, here's like, the thing, right? The difference, this is not mine, a good Marxist friend of mine put it this way, is like the difference between, you know, us well-meaning academics and the rest of the ruling class is that when we're up against the wall and handed a cigarette when the revolution comes, we're going to be like, yeah, I deserve this. Bourdieu called academics the dominated sector of the dominating class. And that's something I think about all the time, right? It's a really accurate description, like, of what we are and what we're capable of and the crises that sort of emerge out of that particular position, right? To be sort of in a position of sort of outside a particular majoritarian sort of sphere of thinking, but so dependent on and sort of embroiled within it as to be culpable for all its sins, you know.
I always wondered, do like white people who study like 18th century, 19th century, do they see it as like research? Like I always wondered that. Like I don't think they do.
Yeah, I think it depends, because I do think that I think it's more in, I mean, I don't know if anyone's going to even respond to or listen to the episode that I'm on, but if anybody does, they may call me out on this, but I feel like there's a strain of particularly British scholarship, English scholarship, that's like where people literally study their own bloodlines and, you know,
yeah, that is true.
I think there is a very deliberate kind. There isn't, I mean, I take your point though, right? Which is that quote unquote me-search is tends to be the sort of provenance of minoritized scholars in different ways. And that gets written off as such because of that, right? That gets dismissed as not rigorous because it acknowledges the subject position of the scholar in question and takes seriously that position in its in the way that knowledge sort of comes to us and is processed. So that does get written off in, you know, darker scholars by lighter scholars. I think that happens. And obviously I'm not talking about phenotype when I divide the world into light and dark that way. I'm sort of using the Du Boisian division between the white world and the dark world, or the global north and the global south. But yeah, I mean, I think we do by and large get treated as less rigorous when we talk about brown people talking about brown things becomes niche and me-searchy and not rigorous. Yeah. In ways that anybody talking about Dickens is not is not subject to that kind of
scrutiny. Yeah, no, there is, you are interpolated as like the subject, as like a subject of your research somehow when you are like a blank person doing blank studies. And yeah. A lot of people sort of turn into the skid intentionally on that one, right. And are happy to play the role of like, as a blank, I will, you know, right. And like people love that, and it works for a lot of people. And I can't begrudge people that. Like, I think there is a part of me where there was a part of me where I was like, oh, these fucking people. And I think a lot of times my own research agenda was like reactionarily, if that's a word, based against that view.
Yeah.
Of like, I'm not going to do me search. I don't want to do me search. This is the last thing I want to do. Although now I do me search all the time somehow, like in this show. Although like I kind of, I shy away from Iran stuff recently. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Iran. You can't win because then you're thrown to the lions, say in like the Iranian context, whereby like even being too loud against sanction and like,
right.
You know, like the, you know, the sort of 24-hour hexing of Iran is like deemed to be like, oh, you're not too friendly to the Islamic Republic. Like those typical kind of like liberal, right. those harsh blocks put into place, ideological like roadblocks or whatever, or like concrete barriers that liberals love to put up but never acknowledge that, like, oh, like you can't talk like this too glowingly about, you know, these dictator types, like you can't. And I feel that instantly overlays anything that happens in any community in the academy, because like it is a liberal space and the liberal rules of the game apply. And like, and that's what that means in the Iranian context. It means a certain thing. I mean, I think there is a tendency to also ghettoize people and like put them in their ghettos and like, okay, you could talk about whatever crazy wacky thing you want if you want to sit in that one corner over there and don't be too loud. And like that's, and like if you're lucky after 20 years of service, we'll give you another corner. Like, like that's like one model. And that's, again, don't begrudge people for doing that. Like people got to earn their pay. Like, what are you going to do? Like, you know, so, but these are structural limits. These are things that like, you can't push back on the academy. You can't like, you can't be like, I demand to be validated. Like you can't, it doesn't work like that. System doesn't care about you.
No, they pretend it never will. I mean, yeah, the president of relatively new president of Rutgers likes to call us a beloved community, which just makes me gag.
Beloved? Come on, man. Beloved? Oh, nobody talks like that in our society. Beloved.
But it's, I mean, so regarding the question of me search, and yeah, I mean, I sort of oscillate, though. I will say, like, it's been certainly part of, like, my work. You know, especially, you know, I work on brownness, and I identify as brown, right? So it's not a far stretch from to assume that, like, you know, it's me search. You know, it sort of depends on where I am at a particular moment and, you know, what I'm interested in and what I'm thinking about. I mean, my work on Guyana, really interestingly, is not, I think of it as very much not me search, not least because, so, you know, I spent a lot of time in Guyana. And your listeners should go back and listen to the interview I did with Vidya Kasun about Guyanese LGBTQ rights. You know, I do a lot of work in Guyana. And the weird thing is that when I'm there, I always have to explain that I'm not Guyanese. You know, that like my parents came from Punjab to the U.S. And there is no sort of passage through Guyana. Because if you're brown in Guyana, they assume, you know, that you have some actual connection to the place. And it was purely intellectual. I mean, I was interested in Guyana because I was interested in colonial poets. And there was one poet in particular, Egbert Martin, who's the first Afro-Guyanese Anglophone poet, you know, who I became really interested in. So I started working on Guyana. So there's that stuff, which is not rooted in my own sort of, you know, my own identity crisis. But then there's other things where, like, you know, when I talk about, like, I've written about and I've reflected on precisely what you were talking about earlier. And you're like, I have a really vexed relationship to a lot of these figures that that I work on. You know, not so much the poets. I like the romantic poets fine, but you know, I do a lot of work on Kant, and that's somebody. I mean, he was such a fucking racist. I mean, talks about like wrote about you know the sort of inherent natural foul smellingness of Black peoples. Right? I mean, was just completely ignorant and from his like you know perch in Königsberg pontificating about the inferiority of people you know from non-European
spaces. Can you imagine
spaces.
Sitting in fucking Königsberg, Germany and fucking thinking you're the this is the end of history, you're the, bro.
This is right, yeah, this is the center of the right, so here's you know but I mean, the truth of the matter is like this guy who like is offensive in every way, I find him fascinating. And I like, you know, I spend probably more time working on and reading Kant than so far in my life than any other figure. You know, I find him complex and interesting and weird. I mean, he has like, you know, he's like the father of modern philosophy, and yet he'll get away with saying stuff like, you know, there are a few things in the world that are naturally and inherently beautiful, like crustaceans and crawfish. You know, it's just like nonsense. Like, but and yet he like, you know, revolutionized our way of thinking about subjectivity. So I have these I have this vexed relationship with Kant, with Byron, with Keats, you know, with these figures. And that does manifest itself in my scholarship in a way that I think does sort of like would sort of qualify it as me search, you know, when I'm writing on these figures. But so it's not all of it. It's certainly some of it. At the end of the day, have I added something to the sort of knowledge that's out there that accords with like my ethics and politics? Some days I get there and some days I don't. I think that's the short of it for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like our interventions as individuals are small and they're local, and that's like what we can do as individuals. And there is this bad idea that pervades, I think, a lot of people, not just inside but also outside academia, which ultimately does harm to a lot of actual working academics, is that like that there's something immensely noble about working in a university or a college, yeah. That like there is this ethical task now. Teachers all have an ethical task, yes, like every teacher, right. Has one, like, you know, grade one kindergarten teacher to college teacher, yes, like that's true. But like the very like middle class and very modern fetishization of university, college, whatever, as this like this uniquely precious moment in our Bildung, you know, yeah. That's something that like, you know, I've had to like shake off as like the years have gone by, of like, you know, like it's just one institution of many in our world. And a lot of people, especially going forward, especially like after our generation, like a lot of people aren't going to be choosing this path. And that's not something to like kill ourselves about. That's not something to like, you know, that's something to ask, like, okay, why are people not like, what's close to them? Obviously the answer is easy. Like, why? It's because it's so fucking expensive, obviously. Right. Like that's not hard to say. So like, that thing, I think, does damage to academics, of like this burden, this ethical burden that's put on, of like, oh, the holiness of this work. But like, ultimately, like, it's just, you know, it's a job, and it's a job that you do. And it's something that like, and so I'm sort of trying to take the sting of what I'm saying out of the episode, saying that like, oh, academics are this and that and whatever. But like, you know, like, you know, what does an academic do that like a dentist doesn't do, or like a, you know, a bricklayer?
I think that's
you're
a really
person
good
in
point.
Society. You're a social person. You have to live in a social world, and you have to get about your life.
Well, and I think that particular model of academia is so divorced from, you know, as ivied towers and a particular sort of hallowed space is, it's just not in touch with the reality. I mean, most college students are not, you know, 18-year-olds and ready to sort of, you know, join a frat on their way to, you know, their bio class that's in like a $5 million classroom with cutting edge equipment. I mean, most college students are older, are returning, are living at home rather than on campus, are doing, you know, living lives as like, you know, just everyone else, and taking classes. And that's something that I, you know, I it's not like I came into the profession knowing that. You know, I went to relatively elite schools. But when I started working at Rutgers Newark, and realized that, like, you know, my students weren't like going back to their dorm to do bong hits. I mean, some of them were maybe, you know, had like full lives as caregivers, as employees, as employers, as religious subjects and members of their communities. And that my class was like a very small part of what their life is. It compelled me and has compelled me to rethink the sort of the privilege I sort of, or the halo, or the, you know, the box of some of the preciousness that I associate, have long associated with academia. It's not, it is a, it's a social space, it's an institution, and like you say, it's a job, it's a reality.
Manu, what are you working on these days?
Oh, I have been, so a lot of, I mean, actually informed a lot of what I was talking about today. I've been spending a lot of time working on Du Bois for a book on the history of brownness from the 18th century to the present day. So I look at, I mean, I spent a lot of time with Kant, and Kant's racist shit. And then I work through figures like Du Bois and end up with Walter Rodney, with these really fascinating set of books. I'd love to chat with you about another time. He wrote these great books for children. Each one was sort of representing a different laboring population of Guyana, and the idea was to forge through these children books a you know, a sort of resistant political Marxist community that would sort of lead Guyana into a new era of you know, into a socialist future. So that's the stuff I've been working on now, and I don't know, man. It's like I think, I can't remember if I've ever said this to you, but part of the, a lot of this project is came out of the fact that I, was it 4 years ago, did your show and talked about
Oh,
brownness with you,
I'm so
and
touched,
realized,
man.
it's, you know, I mean, you've created this space and this kinship again, which has allowed me to reflect on these questions and then, you know, run them through my academic brain and sort of think about them from new angles. But I'm really grateful to you. And also, just, man, I'm, you know, I hope this doesn't sound patronizing, but I'm so proud of what you've put, what you're putting together with East as a Podcast, and just all the work you've put into it over the years, and just seeing it flourish, and, you know, you getting your millionth unique download. And I mean, it's just, it's awesome. You really, you remain a model and an inspiration to me. So thank you.
Thank you, man. That's very sweet. And I couldn't have, I, you know, I, I'm, you know, I'm reliant on people coming on my show. You gave me an early boost those days and listened to my show, came along with my wacky idea of a monologic podcast. Oh, those were the days. Oh, those were the pretentious form-obsessed days. You can so tell that like I was an academic turned into a podcaster, because the things that like academics value and like fetishize, like form and narrator and chopping everything up into its constitutive parts, whereas like people who listen to a podcast, they don't care. They just want the content. Like, give them the hot dog. They don't need everything else. Just give them the hot dog, Cena.
I feel like that should be your, I feel like, didn't you went through a lot of different slogans for a while? You know, there's a podcast dedicated to non-white people, a podcast dedicated to West Asian politics, and but how about just like the East is a Podcast, here's
Here's just eat your hot dog. Just
your
eat your
hot
hot
dog.
dog. I don't even know what it is anymore. It has no boundaries. It doesn't matter.
It's
as long
good.
as as long as people are interesting, as long as like the world is like such a big place, you know. Like, I know this is like corny and liberal thing to say, but like it's this infinite place, and like all you have to do is like be curious and like talk to people. And I'm lucky that I know all these people who can like talk and like produce quality hot dog meat for me, in the form of like they could just like spin it out of like a loom for me from their brains. So like that, I'm lucky. And like that's the, like, it's funny, the institutional, I shit on the academy all the time on this show, but like really it enabled me to do this show, both in terms of like the content of what I do, which is like, you know, talking to people and getting people to talk, and you know, like opening up issues and you know, which is a skill. I don't deny that. Like, that not everybody can do that. But also just like the human connections that it gave me, like the just the emails and, you know, like, oh, so and so, and then the networks that network can then, like, if I needed someone that, like, you knew, like, I just reach out to you, and like that's the institutional power of like 10, 20, 30,000 people working around the world on these very small niche topics that, like, if you can plug into this network and be part of it. And, you know, in my work, I try to think of it as like amplifying others and their work, like at least to a degree, then like you benefit from them and giving me their time. You know, like, that's, people come on my show, they give me hours of their time, and I give them nothing. Like, you get nothing for this. You get a tweet. Like, that's what I did. You know? So, like, I'm in the best business possible. Like, I do nothing. I do nothing comparatively. And I siphon all this sweet hot dog drink from people's brains, and then I just peddle it to people in front of a baseball game or something, and it works, and people pay me money. So, and I'm happy about that. But I also get to learn. I mean, really, the money is whatever. I mean, whatever. I like money. Give me money, please. But like, I like the learning, and like the learning and the talking and the socializing is what I like. That's what I liked about university too. Like, that's what I liked most about university, obviously. Like, I didn't like changing footnote styles, obviously. But I liked I liked the conferences and the parties and, like, getting to know people and being like, what do you do? Like, that's the good stuff. And so much of, you know, anyways, we're sitting here. I'm waxing nostalgic. I said this in the last episode with you that we didn't publish. The further I get from academia, you know, like, there's this, like, double movement that happens in my head. That, like, there are a lot of things that I, like, don't miss, and they don't like jump at me in any real way, like, you know, but there are some things that I miss, and like, it's the kinds of conversations that I had on like a daily basis, I have now on like a weekly basis, and like, you know, and like you know, on like a podcast and stuff, and it's not the same and stuff, and you don't have colleagues and you don't have students, and like, obviously the students I miss the most, but you know, that kind of stimulation, like, you can't intellectual, like, you know, spiritual, philosophical, whatever, like, social, like, you, that's what the university gives you. And you're just like, oh my God, like, you just want to drink life, you know, and just like pump it into your brain. Then there's all the bullshit that gets in between that.
Well, that's the thing, is you become an academic and you realize, like, you know, if you quote unquote make it, you know, I'm a tenured prof now, like, you realize, like, you actually spend very little of your time doing the stuff that is actually nurturing, and more time like dealing with like neoliberal bullshit coming from management, which is, again, that's like probably a topic for another episode. Yeah.
Thank you, Manu. This is a lot of fun.
All right. Sending lots of love, Habibi.
Thank you, Habibi. Take care.